The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
This has been, as you are well aware, a slow-moving attempt to show the multiple nuances of covenant thinking that goes back to the late medieval period and brings us to the, really, as I see it, with Calvin, where I want to argue is the beginning of an authentic federalism. Very much an inchoative beginning form, but the principles are there of what will become later mature federal theology. And saying this, I would remind you that I don't represent the mainstream by any means, that you'll read a lot of people who would argue very much against what you hear here, and that's important for you to understand. You don't have to agree with me. I just want you to hear the evidence for why I think it's true. Okay? So this course is not at all designed to proselytize you. It's designed to challenge you to think about the unity of the Reformed tradition, that there is really a continuous thread that runs through it. Others may see it very much as a polarized system. I'd like to argue that it's much more unified, even though there's a lot of intramural debate, to be sure. Okay. Well, that just simple statement, then. Our lecture for today is an attempt to review the arguments that can be brought forward to claim that Calvin truly belongs in the Reformed heritage. My first attempt at stating this was back in spring 1981 in the Westminster Journal in an article that was entitled Ursinus's Development of the Covenant of Creation, A Debt to Melanchthon or Calvin. So you can, if you'd like to review that, you may. I've tried to perfect it a little bit since then. And there are a number of directions that this article goes in that are not reflected in my dissertation or elsewhere because there are other concerns that I thought were important. But if you'd like to hear at least one attempt to argue that, that would be a place to look. That's in the Westminster Theological Journal, spring 1981. That's volume 2 of that year. Okay, or see, number 2 of the spring 81 edition of the Westminster Journal. Okay, so as we begin to think about this matter of the covenant of works, then you'll recall we used Weir's basic distinction between the idea of just saying a covenant idea, a covenant theology, and a federal theology. And for a federal theology, the notion that we suggested is that this is really something that becomes identifiable when there is a clear covenantal system structuring the flow of salvation from even before the fall on into the redemptive era. So it almost seems to have a federal theology. You need a prelapsarian covenant, a covenant of works, covenant creation, covenant of life, all the different titles by which it is used. And I would basically agree with that. Federal theology is a system in which there is an ongoing covenantal thinking all the way from creation to the end of salvation, at the culmination of the Christian hope. To argue that this is true in Calvin requires a fair amount of challenge to what we hear from a lot of scholarly sources. So let me begin by saying that the first challenge that we have to take on is the question of what was Melanchthon's role in the development of the covenant of works. Many of the Reformed scholars on the continent have said it's really the law-gospel distinction of Luther as mediated through Melanchthon in the German Reformed tradition that gives the Reformed theology its first taste of the covenant of works. And if you remember, along with the idea of the work of Bullinger and Zwingli as the Rhineland Reformers, one of their tensions with Calvin was that they had a lesser predestinarian theology, maybe a one-sided predestination rather than a double predestination. And so that whole notion then is that in the challenge against Geneva and Calvin, there was a milder predestinarianism, there was a closer affinity with Melanchthon and Lutheranism, and out of that milder theology and the law-gospel distinction of Lutheranism, there developed then the covenant of works. The idea that God had made a covenant with all of humanity in Adam. See, that's a universalistic idea. Everybody was in covenant with God through the covenant head Adam. And the benefit was life. And that was a law covenant that is very much in contradistinction from a grace covenant. So you see, there's the tension between law, grace, universalism. And in terms of the historical phenomenology, it's significant to realize that Ursinus and the Levianus were German Reformed theologians. They were in the Palatinate. And so they were, as they work, they are the first in their dialogues, and particularly Ursinus, to develop articulately the notion of a covenant in creation before the fall. So you have a geographical centrality, you have an affinity with law gospel, you have the tension alleged between predestination versus a more mild Reformed theology, and it all seems to fit. So that it's really Melanchthon who is the impetus for federal theology. And by the way, that would be, again, very ironic. It's of akin to saying that the Anabaptists really gave the Reformed tradition covenant theology. But to say it's, well, if it wasn't the Anabaptists, at least it was Melanchthon, who was, as you know, nearly a semi-Pelagian by the end of his life. He had really moved long away from Luther's strong teaching on the bondage of the will and predestination. So I hope you sense a little bit of the scholarly ironies that are being perpetrated upon the Reformed tradition. So the reason this makes me wear an apologetics type hat is because I'm frustrated to think that my heritage is so convoluted, that the very heart of its system is really, and comes from the Anabaptist heritage, and it comes from really almost a lapsed Lutheran. I don't want to be too hard on Melanchthon, but when you read him later, he really has moved a long way from the rugged reformational theology of Luther, because he's very much Aristotelian. He's very much committed to a synergistic type theology almost, with the will having a significant role. Well, be that as it may then, I want to discuss briefly the arguments for the Melanchthonian influences and then try to challenge their effectiveness in this debate. And then I want to talk about the influences in Calvin's theology that helped to form a covenant of works in his thinking and some of the problems in seeing that. Because if Calvin is pioneering, if he is, he doesn't say it all the way later federal theologies will say it. Okay? Any questions on any of that brief introduction there as to what we're going to try to accomplish in our time today? Okay, feel free to stop me at any point. I hope you can see that all of this is a kind of a seamless web of sorts. Turn with me then, if you will, to page 448 in the notes I've given you today. And you'll notice that I give you a couple quotes that come from Ursinus's catechism that he published in 1562, which is 1 year before he co-published the great and abiding Heidelberg Catechism with Levianus. He actually had written two catechisms in this year, so he was quite a catechist. He wrote at least three in his life, and there may have been more. He was working on this product of teaching theology and Christian ethics to the church. And so Ursinus was a great teacher. Now, he wrote in questions 10 and 36 of this catechism called the Summa Theologiae, the Sum of Theology. Question 10 asks the question, what does the divine law teach? Answer, it teaches what sort of covenant, fidus is a Latin word, God entered into with man in creation. In which covenant, now he uses the word pacto. So you see the synonyms of fidus and pactum are there. In which covenant man conducted himself by the keeping of it, and what God demands from him after entering into the new covenant of grace with him. There's the word fidus again. And notice you now have a covenant entered with man in creation, and then you have a covenant that's called a new covenant that is made with him. That is, what sort and toward what end man is formed by God, into which state he is brought, and by what covenant the one reconciled to God is bound to establish his life. Okay, one of the things I want you to know, just on the surface of this, is that this is not the classic Lutheran law-gospel dichotomy. Do you hear the third use of the law is clearly built into this answer? One of the things that's startling to me as I've looked at theologians who've dealt with this is that they fail to see this. That this does not say that there is a law that's entirely distinct in the covenant of works or the covenant of creation from the law that, or from the life of the covenant of grace. Rather, it's the same law from creation and the covenant of works to being the kind of life we live in the covenant of grace. That's the idea of the unity of law and gospel. That in the gospel, the law continues in the covenant. That's continuity. But there's clearly a difference because the covenant of grace is different from the covenant of creation. There's a difference. But the law is the same in both. Okay? And I think that kind of that is the Reformed paradigm worked out. You can find all that in Calvin. Agreement between the law and gospel, and also the first use of the law in its condemning role, but yet letter becoming spirit. That's implicit in question 10. This, as far as historians can tell, is the first time anyone ever spoke of a pre-fall covenant. Okay? So if you're looking for a date for the first time in history where the covenant of works is articulated in some sense, it's 1562. Okay, so I think it's legitimate to say consciously there was not a articulated pre-fall covenant by that name probably until Ursinus. But we're going to show that the idea and the notion of covenant existing before the fall is present in Calvin. But with the phrase of a covenant of creation, that's something that first clearly is defined by Ursinus. And as far as I can tell, no one has ever been able to find anything earlier. Okay, yes. Okay, those are great questions. Let me answer them here. We may touch a little bit later on that. But in the article that I mentioned, I'd go into that at greater length, and that's where you could hear a better answer. Yeah, in the Westminster Journal. But let me say a couple things to answer your question. First of all, those that argue for the Melanchthonian influences will note that Ursinus was a friend of Melanchthon. He used his examen ordinarium, his examination for ordination in the theological schools that Melanchthon had written. So he used Melanchthon's textbook. He knew him. He taught in the same general's field with him. So they say, well, here's the natural connection. He's in the Platonate, the German Reformed. He knows Melanchthon. He's using his text. So that's an excellent argument to say, well, it's Melanchthonian. But what most people aren't aware of is that Ursinus actually had a very remarkable conversion experience that occurred one day when he was out boating, as I understand it, and the boat capsized and he nearly drowned. And as he was going down for the third time almost, this is a true story now. It doesn't sound like it, but it's important. As he was going down, it's kind of like Luther said, I'll serve St. Anne if you spare me. I'll go into the convent. Well, Ursinus said, Lord, if you spare me, I'll spend the rest of my life studying Calvin's theology. That's true. That's a true story. And so, Ursinus was a great student of Calvin's writings. And he was clearly a Calvinist. And at the end of his life, he was a president of one of the great Reformed seminaries of theological schools of his day. So he clearly identified himself with the theological schools, even at the expense of getting out of sorts with the Lutherans in his area. He was consciously Reformed. He was president of a Reformed theological school. And he relates that story and said, I've been committed to Calvin's writings ever since I got serious about theology. He knew Melanchthon, of course. He was not afraid of Melanchthon, but he saw his roots in the Reformed tradition in Calvin. So one of the things that I'd like to suggest is that from his very own heart, he was looking at things from a Reformed angle. And after all, Melanchthon had some Calvinistic elements in his thinking. He was the leader of the crypto-Calvinist movement, if you will, when it came to the Lord's Supper. And in some areas, Melanchthon was very non-Lutheran, non-Reformed. So he was really a multi-variegated theologian. Melanchthon is something of an anomaly. You can find lots of roots in his thinking. So I feel that in terms of historical sources, you can argue just as strongly for Calvin's heritage and Ursinus as you can Melanchthon, because he says, I spent my life, I committed myself, and he ended up teaching not in a Lutheran school, but in a Reformed school, and he was conscious of what his choices were. Okay, so that's a beginning of an answer. Okay, but we're going to look at some of the theological ideas to see connections more fully later. But right here in question 10, I simply suggest to you that what you see there is the letter-spirit distinction at work in his teaching. And that's clearly Calvinistic, not Lutheran. Number 36 says, what is the distinction between the law and the gospel? Okay, this is a great question here. And what does he say? The law contains the covenant of nature. Okay, so now we see again the phrase, not only the covenant in creation, but the covenant of nature. So the idea of this initial covenant built upon law of God's demand and the moral order of Eden. It says, it is entered into by God with men in creation. That is, it is known by men through nature, and it demands from us perfect obedience toward God, and by performing it, it promises eternal life. By not performing it, it threatens eternal punishment. But indeed, the gospel contains the covenant of grace. Okay, so there is probably the earliest, most clearly articulated tension between the covenant of nature or creation and the covenant of grace. And that's in that same catechism. The reason that this is important is that clearly you see a law-gospel distinction, and that the covenant of works is legal. The covenant of grace is not primarily legal. But to read question 36 outside of the context of what came before in question 10 is to misread the catechism, because he's already made it clear that the law continues on into the covenant of grace and shows us how we live for God. So there is the third use of the law. There is the mutuality of the covenant. Okay, and that's where I think we need to see both. So the question as we look at Calvin and the Reformed tradition, is there such a thing as a clear law-gospel distinction? And of course there is. Before a man comes to Christ, law and gospel are two ways of coming to God. The covenant of works and the covenant of grace are different. But when we come to Christ, the notion in the Reformed tradition is that the letter that slew us in the covenant of works becomes now the spirit that guides us in love toward God in the covenant of grace. There's continuity and discontinuity. Okay? So that's an important distinction. Now let's go to page 449. I won't review all the various scholars who have taken the view to say that we look to Melanchthon, but that's the datum. Now, the second paragraph on 449, there are two critical ideas at the center of this assertion of Melanchthonian influence. The first is Melanchthon's teaching on natural law and his law-gospel distinction. So in other words, two key ideas that have been persuasive for the continental scholars with respect to Melanchthon's influence is the idea of this natural law concept that is in Ursinus that we can find in Melanchthon, and that secondly, the strong law-gospel distinction. So those are the two things they say. That's what Ursinus got right from Melanchthon, and that's what ultimately gives the Reformed tradition its federal structure. Okay, the covenant of works, covenant of grace. Long writes, I'm translating him here, he says, Ursinus discovered the creation covenant whose content is later repeated by the law, which was a development otherwise unparalleled by the other reformers. This only can be explained by Melanchthon, who in his loci, like Ursinus, places the law of nature on a par with the innate imago Dei and with the revealed law in the narrower sense. And so Lang says basically that it's the Melanchthonian image of God teaching that gives us this whole influence on Ursinus, that sees the natural law or the law of nature as being on a par with the Decalogue, the law, and it says that we need Melanchthon for. And it's that influence that gives us this. Okay, look again, another great scholar, or he goes on in the next page, let me finish the quote. He'll say, quote, Calvin, on the other hand, does not want to know much concerning the darkened law of nature. In other words, Calvin has no room for any notion of natural law. Similarly, another outstanding continental scholar, Althaus, states, the Institutes, as another expression, was very reserved. Calvin speaks therein indeed of the law of nature and maintains the principle of the identity of the inner law with the Decalogue. Okay, so in other words, he wouldn't quite agree with Lang. He says, well, there is some identification between the two. But he goes on to say, but even stronger, he stresses the empirical depravity of the moral judgments, on account of which the law of Scripture was necessary. Moreover, he did not think thereby to identify the legal covenant with a covenant of nature or covenant of creation. So what are his claims? He basically says to Lang, and of course they were not writing directly to each other, but as you compare their notions, He says, well, Calvin does hold something of a continuity between the law of nature and the Decalogue. We recognize that. But we must say, because of his emphasis on depravity, he doesn't really care a whole lot about what God did in creation. Man's fallen, that pre-fall situation is not really important. And there is no sense in which we can identify the legal covenant, which does exist in Calvin's theology, with that pre-fall covenant of creation. There's no connection between the two. Okay, so that's at least, he modifies Lang's position slightly, but he says there's no basis for it. Okay. And then one other example of Sturm, another theological mind on the continent, says, while it is true that one can find the idea of the fidus legale in Calvin, he said, now see, he's saying, well, Calvin does use the phrase covenant of law, after all. It is not used in the sense of the fidus creationis. The covenant of law and covenant of creation are never identified by Calvin. Here the word law signifies God's revealed law, but not natural law. The fidus legale is the covenant with Moses. Over against this, Ursinus's idea of the creation covenant is oriented toward Melanchthon's doctrine of natural law. So there's basically where the position on the continent has been, that you have these two ideas of Mosaic law, which can be called in Calvin a covenant of law, but it's never identified by Calvin with the pre-fall environment. And that only in Melanchthon's influence on Ursinus, with his strong emphasis on natural law, could we explain what Ursinus does. Okay, so that's the first influence. The second feature, the bottom of the page 450, of the Melanchthonian influence on Ursinus's development of the covenant of creation is his law-gospel distinction. Okay, and now basically what he's claiming here is that there really is a unique Melanchthonian law-gospel distinction that was necessary to put these two covenants in tension. Okay, so Ursinus, to quote him, to just get a little feel for his law-gospel distinction, we'll say at the top of 451, there are two parts to the doctrine of the church, law and gospel, by which the sum total of Holy Scripture is contained. The prophetic and apostolic scriptures contain the Old and New Testaments, or covenant between God and men. Therefore, it is necessary in these to explain clearly the heads of the covenant, to be sure what he promises and fulfills for us, and what in turn he demands from us. Okay, so that's Ursinus explaining the strong emphasis on law, gospel, the two heads of the covenant. And so the idea here that the scholars will say is that that's what we get from Melanchthon, a strong law-gospel distinction, and Ursinus then applies it to covenantal thought. Okay? Now go down to the middle of page 451. It says, while Calvin did hold to a strong law-gospel distinction, he also tried to identify the Old and New Testaments as the same covenant. And thus, quote, Calvin's covenant teaching kept itself generally in a marked lack of clarity. Okay, that's Althaus writing. He says, because of Calvin's great emphasis on the continuity of the covenant, that he was never able to articulate a clear law-gospel distinction like we find in Ursinus. Now, I'm going to challenge that. I think what we find in Calvin is he clearly says there is a law-gospel distinction, but it doesn't overthrow the unity in the substance. Okay? There's discontinuity and continuity. Althaus simply says that the distinction is insufficient in Calvin. It doesn't have clarity, and therefore, for it to be so strong in Ursinus, it really must come from Melanchthon. Okay? So those are the two basic ideas that have been brought forward. There is a third area, which we won't talk about at any great extent here, and that is that also in the baptismal teaching of Melanchthon, there's a claim that the idea of covenant is significant, and that may well have also had some influence on Ursinus. But we won't pursue that at this time. In my article, there's more information on that. Okay? Now, let's go to page 453. Having kind of played out the two major Melanchthonian influences that scholars have said helped shape Ursinus's thought to give forth the covenant of works, how do we respond? Well, the first full paragraph. Is it true, then, that the emergence of the concept of a covenant of works is a result of Melanchthon's influence upon Ursinus? In light of his contact with Calvin and other Reformed theologians, it is plausible to suggest that the stimulus for his theological development came from their influence. So Let's challenge then the alleged Melanchthonian influences. The first issue then to be considered is the doctrine of natural law. The question simply is Melanchthon's way of expressing it in some way unique to him, such that if we find it in her sinus, it would have to be termed Melanchthonian natural law. And I think the problem that I'm going to argue for is that there's nothing distinctive about Melanchthon's view of natural law, and that, frankly, what he does is a commonplace of all of the reformers. Okay, the only way that you could denominate it Melanchthonian is if it were uniquely his, and it was of such a cast that no one else used it. But that's not the case. His idea of identifying natural law with the Decalogue is something that, in fact, Melanchthon is done by all the reformers. And so, for example, let's look at Melanchthon first. The first quote says, "Therefore, it is a true definition of the law of nature that the law of nature is the knowledge of the divine law inborn in men by nature. Whence, indeed, man is said to be formed in the image of God, because the image shines in him, that is, the knowledge of God in a certain likeness of the divine mind, that is a discrimination of honesty and disgrace. And with this knowledge, the moral strengths of men correspond." Okay, so in other words, surely there's a great emphasis on natural law and the Decalogue in Melanchthon. But it must also be noted that Calvin held very similar views. So I turn the page. Let me just give you a couple examples out of the Institutes. Calvin, writing in Book 2, Chapter 8, Paragraph 1, "The very things contained in the two tablets are in a way dictated to us by that internal law written and stamped on every heart." Can't find any difference. The notion is the same. The Decalogue is written by nature on the hearts of men. Again, Book 4, 2016, Calvin says, "The law of God, which we call moral, is nothing other than the testimony of the natural law and of that conscience which God has engraved on the minds of men." So in other words, there is this notion in the reformers, Melanchthon and Calvin, and you can find similar ideas in Luther, that the Decalogue was part of man's knowledge in terms of his being the image bearer of God, that there is this sense of conscience that comes by being a moral creature in God's universe. Again, in John 3:6, Calvin comments in there on that passage saying, "The gifts which God hath left to us since the fall, if they are judged by themselves, are indeed worthy of praise. But as the contagion of wickedness is spread through every part, there will be found in us nothing that is pure and free from every defilement. That we naturally possess some knowledge of God, that some distinction between good and evil is engraven on our conscience, that our faculties are sufficient for the maintenance of the present life, that in short we are in so many ways superior to the brute beasts, that is excellent in itself so far as it proceeds from God. But in us all, these things are completely polluted." So what you see in Calvin is he's saying there are remarkable qualities of man as God's image bearer, including his knowledge of right and wrong, bearing the image of natural law or moral law on his heart, even though he's depraved. So one of the contentions of Althaus was, you know, and Lang, is that because Calvin wants to emphasize depravity so much, that the idea of natural law continuing in fallen man is unimportant. Well, Calvin says exactly the opposite. He says it's worthy to be praised. It's significant. It is there. So, again, the evaluation of Calvin, I don't think, is accurate. Calvin wants to say it's polluted. It's useless to bring us right before God. Okay, you're saying it well. I think the point that I'm trying to say is that we don't want to allow the Melanchthonian character of his language to confuse the fact of the Calvinistic character of his ideas. And I think that, you see, there are things that we're trying to hammer home at this point, that there is still a natural law theology in Calvin, which he will never give any room to bring a man to salvation, not for a moment. But see, to make it distinctively Melanchthonian, which is what they're trying to argue for, is that we have to destroy somehow the fact that Calvin would allow this, that it wouldn't be room for him, that somehow it's uniquely Melanchthonian. And that's what I'm taking away. I'm saying it's not uniquely Melanchthonian. The ideas even in Calvin, even that's why this John 3:6 passage to me is very critical, because he emphasizes it's polluted, but it's still glorious. And see, there's a tension in Calvin's theology that allows us to say, no, he did not throw out that humanistic concern that Melanchthon was reflecting, which is that natural man has dignity and significance in his mind and his nature. And that's why Calvin's Imago Dei teaching is fascinating. It's not a destruction, but it's a corruption. There's something really dignified there. And he will make the point that you get into the idea of common grace. There's a notion of common grace in Calvin's theology that all goes along with the same idea that gives man dignity. So I'm prepared to yield to the Germanic influence and even the parallel of language, but my idea is not so much the language, but the informing of those ideas are Calvin's theology. He's bringing it back to bear. So the point that I would grant to you at your stage is, yes, there is something distinctively your sinus over against Calvin. He's not Calvin, but he's not anti-Calvinistic. So much so that he must be laid at the feet of Melanchthon and say, well, he's really Melanchthon student. He's a hybrid. The language is Germanic. There's forms that are even Melanchthon-like, but he is not saying something that we must say is only Melanchthon could have given it to him. That's what I'm arguing against. Okay? Now, do you want to respond to that? Go ahead. Okay, you raise an issue that's important. I would say that there are multiple places in Calvin where I didn't take time to read all of them. I gave you references to pursue, but he will often say things like the two great benefits of the covenant are justification and sanctification. And one of his examples I think I shared last time was that in the covenant, he says, you can't tear the covenant in pieces and just have justification and not sanctification. And then he'll also say, you can't tear Christ in pieces and just have justification and not sanctification. So his teaching of union with Christ and covenant are very similar, and that he's connecting them as inseparably joined in his union with Christ motif, but also in his covenantal motif. And when he does that, I think he'll, for example, in the Lord's Prayer teaching, he will say, well, when we pray the Lord's Prayer, we pray, forgive us our debts and lead us not into temptation, claiming the two parts of the covenant. So, in other words, and he'll say the covenant is a whole. You can't have one without the other. There's another example. I think I read a passage there where he says, we must recognize that the covenant calls us not only to the free gift that it gives us, but also to pledge our fealty and obedience, and that they both are there. So that frequently he will say they're inseparable, and it isn't in the language of the covenant. What I tried to do last time was to show you that it is not bound exclusively to the covenant. My first several quotes were just to say, look at how grammatically different it is. And then when he goes to explain elsewhere why it is, often he will do it in terms of you can't tear the covenant in pieces. So that's the explanation. So again, the question is it legitimate to do systematic theology on Calvin? In other words, can you organize a man's thought in a way that he does not do himself? Well, I think there's a sense in which you have to say that's what theology claims to be, a consistent whole. And so you take the parts and you put them together. And there may be times you could say, well, can we let can we let his union with Christ theology be swallowed up by his covenant teaching? Well, I don't want to do that. And if that's what I'm accomplishing, that's a mistake. That's a legitimate distinction to pursue. But on the other hand, to say that he can say almost the same thing with just a few changes of words is something very significant, that he's thinking in a synonymous way. Not so much that he's a covenantal theologian, that he can only talk this way. There are some theologians that's the way it is. And I'm willing to say, oh, there's maybe a greater emphasis or a different style. And see, in an apologetic type work as I'm doing, my concern is not to preserve all the nuances at every stage. It's to say, if it's been denied, I'm trying to say, wait a second, the denial is so great that you're missing something that's very basic here. And could there be perfections? Absolutely. I'm willing to say that there would be a number of key distinctions between Ursinus and Calvin. I'm quite prepared to accept that. And if you're calling for greater nuance, absolutely. If you're saying, well, are these nuances so different that there's a different system of theology, I'm prepared to say I don't agree with that. I think what it is that's what a hybrid is. He's looking to take what he knows and yet agree with what he believes and say, how does this all fit? And that's the nature. And so I'm not Hegelian here, but theology has a Hegelian cast to it, where there's this synthetic process going on. And so that's why there's development. Ideas come along. So I'm not trying to challenge for a moment the fact that there are nuances and differences and developments, but that's not my purpose. My purpose is to challenge what has almost been a monolithic negation and say there's nothing there. And I'm trying to say, wait a second, there's a lot here. But now having done that, there may be plenty of room to come back and say, well, we better perfect this, and I'm glad to hear that. Okay, go ahead. Okay. Well, those are good remarks. Thank you for that. Let's continue on. Okay. The point that I've been trying to raise here is the similarity of the notion of the natural law and the Decalogue, not only in Melanchthon but also in Calvin. And the thing that I came to before we stopped for our discussion was the idea that Calvin does not diminish for a moment his doctrine of natural law in light of his view of man's sinfulness. And what I want you to see now is that early on, that's what Melanchthon also did. Okay, so that there's even a sense in early Melanchthon, there's continuity. So the quote at the bottom of 454 says, "For in general, the judgment of human comprehension is fallacious because of our innate blindness, so that even if certain patterns of morals have been engraved on our minds, they can scarcely be apprehended." So Melanchthon takes the noetic effects of sin, at least in his early theology, very seriously, even as Calvin does. So the first thing that I want to see then is that we can find in Melanchthon and Calvin a continuity between the idea of man's having natural law and its identity with the Decalogue, and also the fact that it's not really all that valuable to man after the fall. In fact, at the top of 455, similar comments can be found for the editions of the Loci Communis by Melanchthon in 1535, 43, and even in his final edition of 1555. So one of the things about Melanchthon that's fascinating is that he does soften his position with respect to free will, but yet he still will emphasize man's depravity. So there's, could properly be said, a paradoxical or confusing character to Melanchthon's theology. Okay. So the conclusion I've tried to reach on 455 underneath the quote from Melanchthon, let me just highlight it. It says, "The obvious conclusion in the light of this evidence is to assert that there is really no difference in the conception of natural law found in Melanchthon or Calvin with respect to its being identical to the Decalogue and being written on all men's hearts by their creation in God's image." So that, in a sense, Melanchthon, even in his final edition of the Loci, is prepared to affirm that, even as Calvin. So my challenge in the debate that I brought here is that, is it possible to say it's distinctively Melanchthonian? And I say, unless you can do better to show a difference, I'm not prepared to accept that. Okay? Now let's go to the top of 456 for the second allegation of the law-gospel distinction. Again, we noted in the early edition of the Catechism by Ursinus that there is that notion of the law-gospel distinction. Well, listen to what Melanchthon will say now as we again go to his loci. Quote, "Generally speaking, there are two parts to Scripture, law and gospel. The law shows sin, the gospel grace. The law indicates disease, the gospel points out the remedy. To use Paul's words, the law is the minister of death, the gospel is the minister of life and peace." Now that sounds nearly like it might have been a directly absconded text for the catechism from Ursinus. That's almost exactly what Melanchthon said. It's almost what Ursinus said, one-to-one correspondence, very similar. Now let's go on. "Now when one turns to Calvin, assuredly, Althaus is correct in asserting that his identification of the Old Testament is evangelical. This is borne out in his statement to the effect that the covenant made with the patriarchs is so much like ours in substance and reality that the two are actually one and the same, yet they differ in the mode of dispensation. I'd like to suggest, however, that Calvin, even though he emphasizes the evangelical unity of law-gospel, and will even focus on the agreement between law and gospel, does not jettison entirely the law-gospel distinction. So you come to Romans 10:4. Let me, again, another passage from Calvin. He says, "The promises of the gospel, however, are found only here and there in the writings of Moses, and these are somewhat obscure, while the precepts and rewards appointed for those who observe the law frequently occur. The function, therefore, of teaching the character of true righteousness is, with justification, properly and peculiarly attributed to Moses, as is also the function of showing the nature of remuneration which awaits those who observe it, and what punishment awaits those who transgress it. For this reason, Moses himself is contrasted with Christ by John when he says, 'The law was given by Moses, grace and truth came by Jesus Christ.' Whenever the word law is used in this restricted sense," okay, and there's that idea we talked about of the narrow use of the law in Calvin, "in this restricted sense, Moses is implicitly contrasted with Christ. We are then to see what the law contains in itself when separated from the gospel. I must therefore refer what I say here to the righteousness of the law, not to the whole office of Moses, but to that part of it which was peculiarly entrusted to him." And so what we see as you look at that fairly substantial quote is that he's saying there is a law-gospel distinction, that we can see the law in its narrow sense standing in tension with the gospel, and that there is a unique blessing that awaits the law-keeper. There is a promise that awaits there that is not the same promise, if you will, of the gospel, which provides grace. There is law-gospel distinction. And the question then comes up, is it appropriate to see the law-gospel distinction that Melanchthon sees and Calvin sees as sufficiently the same that we can say it is not necessary to say it's uniquely Melanchthonian, that we would look for the covenant of works only from Melanchthon? We'll take a break right there and we'll come back.